May it please the court. My name is Francis Herbert White III, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Ms. Cynthia Rolo Carlson, and an appeal from the Federal District for the State of Minnesota. Ultimately, Your Honors, this is a question of statutory interpretation. As Judge McKinnon noted almost 40 years ago, a regulation, in this case a requirement, perfectly reasonable in the face of a given problem may be highly capricious if that problem does not exist. In this case, the problem doesn't exist. U.S. Army veteran Jeremiah Flaccus Carlson was found deceased in his quarters on October 11, 2015 in St. Cloud, Minnesota. His cause of death was listed as an opioid overdose. Indeed, the St. Cloud VA had been treating the deceased for over a year with mental health medications and opioids. Jeremiah's next of kin, his mother, Cynthia Rolo Carlson, and his stepfather, sought to get some answers from the St. Cloud VA Medical Center regarding the untimely and unnecessary death of their son. Their search failed. Having collided with the brick wall of the VA, Ms. Carlson and her husband retained this firm. On September 5, 2017, and within the statutory period of limitations for the FTCA, the VA received a signed Standard Form 95, as well as our letter of representation, signed by Ms. Carlson, who noted herself as Jeremiah's next of kin. These can be found in Joint Appendix 45 through 48. The VA acknowledged receipt of Ms. Carlson's claim in their letter dated October 19, 2017, which can be found at Joint Appendix 48. The VA took no further action. Ms. Carlson acquired the necessary status to initiate an action as Jeremiah's trustee on October 2, 2018, from the Benton County District Court in the state of Minnesota, which can be found at Joint Appendix 34, and filed this instant action on October 3rd, 2018, which can be found in Joint Appendix 1. The agency then moved to dismiss the action. Oral arguments were heard in the district court on February 4th, 2019. The district court granted the dismissal dated March 18, 2019. This appeal followed. To begin with, Your Honors, this court's decision in Mader is a dead letter. It's no longer viable. If this panel feels that Mader is indeed as broad as the government proffers, especially in light of the new cases handed down by the Supreme Court and discussed in our opening brief since Mader, then we would ask this panel to refer this matter to the full court, so it could be heard en banc. However, Mader is not as broad as the government reads it to be. The presentment requirement is not jurisdictional. As the government concedes in its responsive brief, Congress must clearly state the threshold limitation on a statute's scope shall count as jurisdictional. The government further states that this court should read 28 U.S.C. 2675 together with 28 U.S.C. 1346 and only find that the presentment requirement is jurisdictional. However, 2675 never discusses that presentment requirement. It discusses evidence of authority to act as part of the presentment requirement. And that statute clearly says that it need only be in writing and for a sum certain.
So how are you distinguishing Mader? How is it that this panel could rule in your favor and not go counter to Mader?
In actuality, Your Honor, it doesn't have to go counter to Mader. Mader doesn't apply to the situation that we're looking at here, because Mader was specifically an interpretation of Nebraska law, which has a requirement that is different than what is required under Minnesota law. So Minnesota law requires that to initiate a claim, you only need to be part of have a certain standing. And that standing is you need to be the next of kin. You could be appointed the trustee, but you don't have to be the appointed the trustee. Nebraska law doesn't distinguish that the way that Minnesota law does.
So that doesn't get to the jurisdictional point. How do we distinguish Mader on the jurisdictional point? I understand how you do it under state law, but aren't we bound by Mader on jurisdiction?
Only if Mader has not been subsumed and overruled in substantial part by Kaiser v. Wilkie, which we referenced in our reply brief.
But there's no facts here, or there's nothing different about this case than Mader in the jurisdictional sense. I understand that under state law it might be different, but in the jurisdictional sense, there's really nothing different about this case factually.
Mader involved a situation whereby the individual lost their ability to represent. So in Ms. Mader, who had been the personal representative for the estate of the deceased, lost that ability when her one-year time period expired. Because there was no jurisdictional requirement that Ms. Carlson acquire any special significance from a state court to initiate the claim, that's where the difference lies. To speak to the difference between Mader and what has happened since, Kaiser v. Wilkie stated that there needs to be there's a five-step doctrine in order for the courts to give deference to agencies' regulatory interpretations. Now, the regulatory interpretation that the agency, in this case the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, is interpreting is 28 CFR 14.2 and supplemented by 14.3. 14.2 states, the administrative claim, when presented, must be accompanied by evidence of his, or in this case her, authority to present a claim on behalf of the claimant as agent, executor, administrator, parent, guardian. A claim based on death, according to 14.3, states a claim may be based on death may be presented by the executor or administrator of the decedent's estate or by any other person legally entitled to assert such a claim in accordance with applicable state law. The state law in this case is Minnesota Statute 3.736, specifically Subdivision 6, which allowed Ms. Carlson to make the claim on behalf of her death, or on behalf of her son for wrongful death. The VA, the agency, received those documents. We know they received those documents because their stamp from the Chicago Regional Office is on both the Standard Form 95 as well as the representation agreement, which identifies her as both the individual bringing the claim, provides the sum certain, and states that she is the mother of the deceased and the next of kin. Those can be found again at Joint Appendix 45 through 48. So the question here is, the government seems to be arguing, and this is in their brief, pages 13 and 14, that while federal law controls the presentment requirements, then elements that are necessary to constitute presentment are governed by state law. If federal law controls, then only two things are needed for presentment: a written claim for a sum certain pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2675, and if state law controls, then it is a writing for a sum certain and evidence of authority to act pursuant to Min Stat 3.736, Subdivision 6. The VA was aware that that the next of kin would have been his parents. The VA was aware of this because Mr. Flaccus Carlson was receiving disability compensation benefits for a single veteran, not for a veteran with any dependents. The government in its brief stated that the next of kin, the parents as next of kin, are third in line in intestacy. And while that's true, the VA knew there was no spouse. The VA knew there were no minor dependents. Mr. Flaccus's age precluded any adult dependents. Accordingly, the Mater now needs to be reviewed and understanding of what is the five-step Kaiser doctrine from Kaiser v. Wilkie. The first step must be, is the regulatory provision genuinely ambiguous? And that can be found in Kaiser at 2415. In this case, it isn't. The regulation that is being interpreted in 14.2 and 14.3 is not ambiguous. It's very clear on its face. The second step is the agency's regulatory interpretation must be reasonable. And that that is a requirement the agency can fail. That can be found at 2415 and 2416. It isn't reasonable. And it isn't reasonable because they fail on the third step, which is the agency's regulatory interpretation must be the agency's authoritative or official position. This cannot be the agency's official position because Mater, the position that the agency is taking, is only applicable in the seven states that comprise the Eighth Circuit. Only in the Eighth Circuit is the agency, is a individual who's bringing a claim for wrongful death on behalf of their deceased next of kin or anybody, required apparently to acquire the imprimatur of the state in order to do so. The fifth, which is applicable here, is the agency's regulatory interpretation must reflect fair and considered judgment. And again, the agency fails because the agency cannot take fair and considered judgment and apply it to seven states within the 8th district. It creates a significant problem that results in a failure for due process and equal protection. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
I'd be fine, Mr. White. Mr. Fuller?
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Assistant U.S. Attorney David Fuller for the United States. As the district court noted, the allegations in this sad case are certainly unsettling. But the court was also right to conclude that it lacked jurisdiction. I'd like to briefly address why. All parties agree on a couple of very important things. First, a legal matter, the FTCA's presentment requirement, the need to properly file a claim with the affected agency and have it decided before bringing suit, is mandatory and jurisdictional. This is plainly spelled out right in the statute. The Supreme Court has made clear for decades that it is jurisdictional, and Congress has never changed this long-standing rule. Now, the second thing, which is factual, that all the parties agree on, is that the plaintiff here never provided evidence to the VA that she had been appointed a trustee under Minnesota law authorized to bring a claim for wrongful death. And in fact, no such evidence existed. She had not been so appointed. Now, this court's decision in Mater says that providing such evidence in writing to the agency is part and parcel of the jurisdictional presentment requirement. The district court was required to follow Mater, and it did not err in doing so. I'd like to talk a little bit about Mater. This en banc decision states a clear rule a properly presented claim under Section 2675A must include evidence of a representative authority to act on behalf of the claims beneficiaries under state law. And this is jurisdictional. The decision in Mader was based squarely on statutory text. And this is very clear from reading Section 3 of the Mader opinion. The statutory provisions from the FTCA that form the basis for this analysis include the statements that create liability on the part of the government only where the United States, if a private person, would be liable under state law. And that language appears in both sections 1346, the jurisdictional section, as well as section 2672 relating to the administrative claim. Another section of the statutory text that forms the basis for the Mader analysis and decision is the statute's statement or language that liability for wrongful death shall be only to the persons for whose benefit the action was brought. And that is from section 2674 of the FTCA statutory language. Minnesota cases, state law that we've cited in our brief make very clear that Minnesota is very strict about this appointment requirement. And in fact, they say that proceeding without an appointment as trustee amounts to a legal nullity. Now, Mader was also grounded in the structure and purpose of the presentment requirement.
As you're discussing Mader, could you also just address your Mr. White's proposition that somehow this case is different than Mader? Do you find any room within Mader to have a discussion about this jurisdictional issue?
No, it strikes me that Mader, as I mentioned, is very broad. It creates a clear rule, at least in states like Minnesota and Nebraska that have this sort of a requirement where someone simply cannot proceed in a wrongful death action unless they've been appointed by the court to do so. So I don't see a distinction. There are certainly some factual differences, but I would just suggest that those amount to differences without a distinction, if that answers your question.
One of the questions that has been raised by Ms. Rollo Carlson is that somehow there's a distinction between presentation of a claim and commencement of an action. And if you look at subdivision 3 of 573.02, it talks about the trustee for commencement of an action. And I think that he's drawn some distinction that presentment of the claim is somehow different. Why is he wrong on that?
Well, again, just returning to Mader, I don't see any difference between the Nebraska law at issue there and the Minnesota law at issue here. This ultimately does come down to a federal question of federal jurisdiction. And granted, Mader, for that analysis, looks to the state law, but there's no procedural question here of making an administrative claim at the state level. We're only talking about a federal administrative claim. And Mader is all about a federal administrative claim, and it looks to the Nebraska law, which is similar to the Minnesota law, and says you have to be appointed for the purpose of pursuing a wrongful death action in order to present this to the agency administratively under the FTCA. So I just am not seeing the distinction. So again, the Mader decision looked at the structure and purposes of presentment. It considered that when Congress set up this scheme, the idea, of course, was that the agency's consideration and the possibility of settlement must be meaningful and real. But the Mader decision says that that is impossible if those negotiations turn out to be ultra vires. And that's at page 802. Mader says the presentation of such evidence is not a pointless administrative hurdle. It is fundamental to the meaningful administrative consideration and settlement process contemplated in sections 2675A and 2672. And just to be clear, Mader did not rest on the regulation. The again, section 3 of the Mader opinion has a discussion of the regulations at the final paragraph of that section, and it points out that its decision is consistent with the regulation, but it was based on the statute, and that's the reason that the Kisor decision is, and deference to agency interpretations of regulations is really inapposite here. The section 4 of the Mader opinion carefully considered the rule from the Supreme Court Henderson decision, which also came down in 2011. And that rule has remained the same as the rule that was applied in the Davis decision, the Title VII case that the plaintiff now says functionally overrules Mader. The rule essentially to determine whether a provision is jurisdictional as opposed to a mere claim processing rule is that Congress must be clear, although magic language is not required, or there must be long-standing, undisturbed Supreme Court precedent. Now, here there was both. The Mader decision discussed that the statutory language was clear, the scheme is clear, and there had been the McNeil decision since 1993 that was undisturbed. And Mader really did not talk about obligations on the agency. It made it clear that this is essentially a pleading requirement of the plaintiff. For the most part, I'll reserve discussion of other issues to any questions that the court may have. But in closing, I would just simply suggest that this situation really was not unfair to the plaintiff. She was represented by counsel throughout. There were clear and repeated warnings about this requirement, both contained in the SF-95 form that was filled out. That can be very easily seen at Joint Appendix page 46. And both pages of it were filled out, and the requirements are stated a couple of times. There was also a warning that appeared in the agency's letter of Joint Appendix 53. And in fact, counsel at one point seems to have learned of the Mader problem several months before their right to bring suit had expired. So when the agency sent its letter in July of 2018, denying the claim because at that time a lawsuit had already been filed, and this is at Joint Appendix 49, that letter made clear you still have 6 months to either proceed in court or come back for reconsideration before the agency. Now, at that time, there was a pending court case, but in fact, the plaintiff then withdrew that first lawsuit, and this is clear from Joint Appendix page 98. But nonetheless, once they then went and got the necessary authorization from the court to proceed in a wrongful death action, instead of going back to the agency, which they still had time to do, they immediately went ahead and filed this current lawsuit, which is something that the district court pointed out in terms of the timing. It was basically just one day later. So they had the opportunity to go back to the agency. It's unclear why they did not. And unless there are further questions, in summary, the United States respectfully requests that the court affirm the decision below based on the absence of jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Mr. White, you have a few minutes for rebuttal, just under two.
Thank you, Your Honor. To begin with, I'd like to say that counsel for appellee has just conceded that the authority was received before filing the instant action for initiating an action. Ms. Carlson did not need evidence of her status as a trustee because it's only necessary to bring an action, not to file a claim.
What about the argument that settlement of the claim would be ultra vires, that without some court approval or court appointment, you couldn't actually settle the claim? So the agency is not required to negotiate with somebody who's not appointed to represent the class of people who are beneficiaries under the trust. And I understand that in this case, the beneficiary are the parents, right? So, I mean, in this case, they're the same persons, and so it's less of a problem. But my mind tells me there are cases where someone could be the next friend, next of kin, I guess, is in North Dakota, they always called it the next friend. But the next of kin could have been a person who's required to settle it on behalf of a class of beneficiaries. But there's no, if you don't go through the appointment process, nobody can, the settlement could cut those people out.
Your Honor, you can settle with the next of kin under Minnesota law. Those cases could, in theory, wait for another day. Finally, I'd like to draw the court's attention to Ramos. There's nothing to suggest that the precedent in Mader, as broadly as the government would like to apply, is still correct. As Ramos suggests, Mader runs afoul of due process and equal protection principles and what every Supreme Court has said about them. Unless every other circuit has misstepped along the way, Mader is unsound. For these reasons, we ask the court to reverse the decision of the district court and remand for further proceedings consistent with this court's opinion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel, and we will take the matter under advisement.